said Wilkes and the robber barons, straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to turn our vision here today once again on the global economy. We're going to look at Greece and the IMF. IMF versus Greece again. Recently wrote an article in Telesur on this. Well, what's happening with Greece? Wasn't there a deal worked out last August where the IMF, part of what's called the Troika in Europe, European Commission, IMF, and European Central Bank, in other words, the institutions of the big finance capitalists who are running Europe now and have been since 1999. Of course, we know that they stuck it to Greece here last August, the Greek government that came into power in January of 2015 attempted to renegotiate the debt deals of 2010 and 2012 with the Troika, and didn't get very far. And went toe-to-toe with him with the Troika a few months, and then capitulated. Syriza, the government party there, looked like it was going to try to go to the mat with the Troika and get some relief on the debt that had piled up in Greece. But it didn't work out, and they collapsed. And once again, for a third time in August 2015, what we got was a new debt deal, debt piled on debt. You see, what the Troika does is loan Greece more money to pay the interest and principal on the loans that they made Greece before in 2012 and in 2010. So they loan Greece more money, and Greece has to pay the interest on the new money to make the payments on the old debt that was owed. It's a debt piled on debt, and interest payments are rising year after year. It's what I call the new financial colonialism or financial imperialism. We have a new form of imperialism emerging here globally, where smaller states become deeply indebted to the larger regions and states of the capitalist global economy. And they keep extracting interest payments from these smaller countries. And, of course, the people have to work and pay taxes and give up social benefits and so forth in order to keep paying the climbing interest bill for all this debt that keeps piling on. And it's a form of exploitation because you, the workers of the country, have to work harder and get less and pay more taxes and so forth in order to make the principal and interest payments on the debt to, in this case, Greece, to the Troika. I believe this is a new form of imperialism, financial imperialism, that is emerging here, and we will see more and more of it. In the U.S., I think we're moving in that direction in the case of Puerto Rico debt. And it's usually smaller, weaker states that become the victims of this new financial arrangement. And we'll see whether this new form of imperialism continues to grow, but I think it probably will. And I'll be talking about this, by the way, the whole Greek debt scenario over since 2010 and the latest developments in my new book that's coming out in June called Looting Greece, the Emerging New Financial Imperialism. Anyway, we'll be talking about that some more because it looks like this Greece situation here is not going away. And as I wrote about it recently in Telesur here, there was a secret conversation between IMF, European IMF officials on March 19th that somehow got leaked to WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks published this. on April 2nd. The transcripts of the secret teleconference among IMF officials that occurred on March 19th, in which the leading IMF directors expressed concern that discussions that were ongoing here since August 15th and continuing between Greece and the IMF's troika partner, the European Commission, were going too slowly. The IMF is getting worried that the details of the deal struck last August, in which Greece would be given $98 billion more in order to almost all the $98 billion is going to pay the interest and principal on previous debt incurred by Greece. And by the way, in my book, digress here a bit, I show how Greece had no debt problem whatsoever, nothing worse than Germany's or France's debt problem until 2009 and 10. In other words, because of the crisis that occurred, you know, the global crisis. So there was no debt problem in Greece until then. And it emerges only in 2009-10 as a result of the crisis. And the reasons for that I explain why Greece got caught in this debt problem. And what was different was that the debt problem was really a consequence of German and Northern European loans since 2005 building up in Greece. Because of this strange arrangement of neoliberal, the euro and so forth, which is a device for the Northern European capitalists to really squeeze the periphery. But that's explained in my book. In any event, what we've got here in 2010, it was no problem until 2010. And then there was the bailout in 2010. Again, the Troika bails out the private investors, hedge funds and so forth, that had loaned money to Greece, pays them off, and Greece gets stuck with the bill. And that was temporary, though. The crisis in 2012, we had a double-dip recession in Europe, and Greece gets whacked again. So they had to, the Troika, provides even more debt, more credit to Greece to pay the 2010 debt. And Greece gets deeper in debt as a result. And then we have the chronic no growth in Europe from 14-15. And, of course, we have the third emerging debt crisis. So it's repeating itself over and over again. And it's really the consequence of the Troika insisting that Greece pay these interest payments. And that whole process has kept Greece from growing, which requires even more debt, loans and credit, which causes the problem to get even worse. So it's a downward spiral for Greece. And I predicted last summer, I was writing quite a bit on this for Telesaur, I predicted, well, this debt crisis is not going away in Greece. It's just a pause, and it's going to reemerge here. And I even predicted it probably would reemerge in the summer of 2016. And would converge with a crisis with the UK, possibly leaving the European Union itself. This is, of course, in my book as well, and what I wrote about and predicted this is now about to happen, because returning to this IMF secret teleconference here about Greece, the IMF was not only concerned that it was going too slow in working out the details with the European Commission, Greece and the European Commission, on terms of implementing the August 2015 $98 billion debt deal, $98 billion, of course, which would go to pay previous debt. It's not a loan, really, to Greece or the Greek people to stimulate their economy. It's just a loan to roll over and keep paying the Troika. And the IMF was going concerned that here it was already March, and Greece's economy was deteriorating further, not surprisingly, and Europe was stagnant, and that the $98 billion further austerity deal imposed on Greece may not be enough. In other words, the IMF secret conversation was we got to increase the austerity on Greece. We got to squeeze them even more in order to pay for the debt, the $98 billion austerity deal was not going to be enough. In other words, that austerity deal, as most European austerity deals, has to do with laying off thousands of government workers, cutting the wages of the rest of government workers, reducing subsidies and government spending to the working classes, and increasing what they have to pay for utilities, and selling off government enterprises. In the case of Greece, this would be ports and airports, and the electric utility company and so forth. And it was privatized. And guess who's going to buy it? It's going to be European, Northern European, German, and other capitalists are buying up this stuff at fire sale prices. You know, good deal for them. And they will get the income from that going forward. So, you know, selling public works and so forth is part of austerity. And in exchange for that $98 billion last August, they imposed the equivalent of austerity, further austerity, in addition to 2010 and 12 terms and conditions, even further austerity last August 15th. Well, now the IMF is saying, well, that's not enough. They're reopening the deal. You see, it's like labor negotiations. Management will always reopen the contract. Contracts don't mean anything if they think they can get away with it. You see, oh, but if unions try to reopen the contract, oh, they go to court, and they stop you. And they only reopen contracts when they think they have the power to do so, you see. And this is the case with the Troika and the IMF. What they're doing is reopening the deal that they agreed to. And there's a concern by the IMF that their partner, European Commission, is not being tough enough on Greece. And therefore, the IMF, which, by the way, did not sign the August 2015 deal, the IMF never does, is never first to sign these deals, it's always last to sign these deals when it sees that both the other parties have put up the credit and the receiving party, the debtor here, has agreed without a doubt and has begun to implement the austerity. Then the IMF will sign and throw some of its money in the pot. Well, you know, we've been waiting, they've been waiting to see whether Greece agrees to the details of the $98 billion additional austerity, which, by the way, also includes big cuts to pensions. You know, they hate that. They hate the fact that retirees have pensions, not just workers who have jobs cut their wages and eliminate their jobs, but those who aren't working cut their pensions, cut their, quote, pension wages as well, intensifying that. Now, you know, the IMF is saying, well, we gotta cut pensions even more. We've got to cut the budget even more spending so that we can end, Greece can end up with a budget surplus. The old deal back in August estimated that Greece would have a 3.5% annual GDP budget surplus. In other words, you get a budget surplus by raising taxes and or by cutting spending. And that Greece, according to the deal, would have to generate a 3.5% budget surplus this year. And that was the estimation based upon that $98 billion. Tax hikes, public work sales, and so forth, spending cuts. Well, Greece's budget this year is coming in at a minus 1.5%, not a plus 3.5%, right? So the IMF is looking at that and it says, we have a continuing recession depression in Greece. They're not going to get the savings to pay our principal and interest. Therefore, they've got to squeeze out even more savings by cutting spending and raising taxes in order to pay. And the IMF is looking at those numbers, not 3.5, but a minus 1.5, so it's a 5% of GDP shift. Well, what's 5% of the Greek GDP, which is about $250 billion their GDP? Well, 5% of that is, you know, somewhere between $10 and $15 billion more that Greece is going to have to squeeze out in terms of austerity. And that's only the minus 1.5% is only the estimate for this year. They don't even have the estimate of how much of a negative budget deficit they had last year. So let's say, you know, it's equivalent that 2015 is about 5% of GDP and 16, 5%. So they're going to have to cut, find a way to cut jobs and wages and pensions and raise subsidies, reduce subsidies and raise utility bills and all the other things, sell off even more in Greece, and come up with another $10 to $15 billion. So we're looking $20 to $30 billion more is what Greece is going to need, according to the IMF. Well, the IMF is saying that you know, we have to come up quickly with an additional austerity package for Greece, because the IMF indicated in these secret conversations that they were increasingly concerned that Greece's next big debt payment, principal and interest repayment, comes up in July. Well, they're concerned because the UK, Britain, is going to vote on June 22nd whether to join or leave, remain or leave the European Union, Brexit, British exit. And there was real concern that if that vote occurs, and it's very tight, very close, then Greece's debt payment coming up a month later might mean a Grexit, a Greek exit, you know, especially if the Troika has to renege on the deal and ask for another $20 to $30 billion in austerity imposed on the Greeks. I mean, they came close last year when the Greek government was negotiating with the Troika to possibly have a Greek exit from the Eurozone and from the Euro itself. Well, the concern of the IMF is that if Britain exits, a month later, the debt payment that Greece can't make unless you impose $30 billion more austerity might result in a Greek exit, a Grexit. By the way, you know, the conservative big banker finance ministers led by Wolfgang Schäuble in Germany, in 2012, they themselves suggested Greece should leave the Eurozone. And that's the position of the hardliners. And we may have a double exit here coming up this summer. And the IMF, of course, is concerned that what's really needed is more taxes and more pension cuts. In this secret conversation they had, that's exactly what they were discussing. Ah, but the tax hikes, not on the wealthy. No, no, the IMF is saying you shouldn't raise the taxes on the wealthy. What you should do is broaden the tax base, which means tax the middle class and working class more, you see. That's what the IMF is talking about now. And also, what's necessary is to cut pensions even more than they have been. There should be no debt relief. The IMF is worried that the European Commission, its partner, may be even discussing just writing off some of the Greek debt, because there's no way the Greeks can pay that debt. They'll go on for the rest of the century in austerity. It's impossible. The debt is too high, and Greece's GDP is not big enough in order to pay it. And they should simply write it off. And there's precedents for doing this. But the IMF does not want to do that, you see. Doesn't want to be a party to that. They want to squeeze the Greeks even more. And so they're saying no, IMF, they're saying no discussions even of debt relief, you know, expunging any of this debt for at least 2 years. And now and the Germans and Schäuble jumped in and say, whoa, 2 years, not ever. Not ever. No debt relief for Greece, ever. Right? And when the IMF, you know, got caught in this firestorm of WikiLeaks here, They had a press conference last week, and they publicly verified that they were recommending even more taxes now on middle and working classes, and even more pension cuts that would be necessary. And presumably, it's somehow come up with another $20 to $30 billion imposed on the $98 billion of last year. This amounts to the tax hikes on the middle class amounts to 1% of GDP, so they want to up that, and the pension cuts already amount to 1.5% of GDP. So, in other words, already they're cutting, making pensioners pay even more than the wealthy who are being taxed. So now they want to tax the middle class and cut even more pensioners, you see. That's what the IMF is talking about, right? It's going to be interesting to see what continues to happen here with this Greek debt situation coming to a head here in July, and of course what happens with the British exit just before that. But what it all represents is that growing problems among the elite and disagreements among the elite in Europe, the capitalist elite there, because the Troika and the European Commission are at odds here, and Schäuble and the finance ministers and bankers of Northern Europe are at odds here, and this thing isn't going away. At the same time, we see cracks in the elites occurring over $350 billion of non-performing loans in Italian banks. Then, of course, we have the so-called social democratic socialist government in France imposing labor market reforms, in other words, make it easier to fire workers in France, and great demonstrations going on over that. So, and then we have the vote of the Dutch saying, no, we don't agree to bail out the Ukraine. So that's causing another crack in the united front there of the ruling elites in Europe, and then the Brexit thing in the UK. The fractures are beginning to emerge all over Europe because there's been no recovery for 8 years now, since 2009, going on 8 years, 2008-09. Europe and the Eurozone has been stagnant at best, and probably in and out of several recessions, at least officially 2011-12 was another double dip recession there, and you could argue that pretty much growth has been stagnant or barely 1% to stagnant here ever since 2013 in Europe. And we see splits occurring between the central bank, Mario Draghi, the chairman of the central bank, and now the Wolfgang Schäuble and others who are finance ministers, Germany and so forth, the hardliners attacking Draghi, and Draghi fighting back now. So, the European Central Bank and the constituent central banks are at odds with each other, just as the IMF is at odds with the European Commission, right? And you got popular discontent occurring in voters in Holland and workers in France and among the liberals there in Italy over the non-performing loans. And then the whole Ukraine situation. Very clearly, things are sort of unraveling little by little, and that's because there's been no real growth. People all over the world, working and middle class folks, are beginning to realize that something is fundamentally wrong, that there's been no recovery for them, even though the wealthy have recovered and gone on to record income and asset growth, stock markets, bond markets, derivatives, so forth. You know, they've done tremendously well. I've talked about that before. Just in the U.S., $10 trillion of income gains. And that's why you see these numbers by Professor Emmanuel Saez, and you see Berkeley, the ELSA project, where he looks at IRS data and income data, just in the U.S., well, globally as well, but in the U.S., and shows that since Obama's been in office, all the net income growth that has occurred since 2009, 97% of all that net income growth has gone to the 1% wealthiest households. Whoa, you know, something is wrong. And now we get all these numbers about U.S. GDP. I'll talk about that shortly because we're going to see a surprise here on April 28th when the first quarter GDP numbers for the U.S. come out. And then we keep hearing about all these job gains in the U.S. Well, that should be a very robust, growing economy. How do you balance out the fact that, you know, we got these record job gains going on month to month, but the economy is flat and barely growing in the U.S.? How do you juxtapose those two contradictory statistics? Well, they are statistics. In other words, they're not real data in the sense that it's the raw actual numbers of jobs or the raw actual growth of the U.S. economy. No, GDP and the employment data are statistics. What's that? That's an operation on the real data. That's with certain assumptions and the formulas and so forth. On the data, on the raw data. Look at the raw job numbers, not the statistical indicators that we call unemployment and employment. Look, this is what's wrong, in my opinion, with the job data, and I'll be talking about this more. I have talked about it some in the past. The raw data, actual number of jobs created, reported, right, get sent to the Labor Department. There's two surveys, one in which the very, the largest corporations, about 400,000 of them, send in actual data to the Labor Department. And then the Labor Department has another survey of 60,000 households it conducts every month to get data on jobs that aren't really reported by the 400,000, because there's like, 8-9 million companies in this country. They're not all corporations and large corporations. You know, the job industry employment report is one of the surveys, and then what's called the current population survey is the 60,000 a month. Okay. What's wrong is that this raw data gets added to by other raw data. And this second group of raw data is based on new business creation, right? There's another survey, new business creation. And the new business creation, you know, when someone creates a job, files, a proprietorship or a limited company or something like that, smaller businesses, right, creates a job. Certain assumptions are made about how many are employed on the average for every new business that's created, filed for, with the local state, Secretary of State, whatever, for each of the states. That's where the data exists. So certain assumptions about new job creation occur, and that's added to the raw data on actual jobs reported. And together, it becomes a statistic. In other words, operations on the raw data and the raw data on the raw data occur, and you get a statistic that's seasonally adjusted and a whole bunch of other formulas involved in it. And out of that comes the employment and unemployment statistic, which is not the raw data. Now, the problem with this new business formation approach, which adds raw data to the other raw data, is that it lags 9 months. In other words, the raw data they're putting on the raw data they get for jobs last month from new business development is for last August and September. and they simply add it to the raw data. Then they do all their statistical operations on it, and that's how you get the job numbers. Another problem is that for every part-time job that's reported, created, it's considered a full job as far as the unemployment statistic is concerned. It's not considered a half job for the U3 unemployment rate. It's considered a full job. Well, that poses problems, because if everyone's getting, or most people are getting temp and part-time and, you know, gig economy jobs nowadays, they have to have more than one job to survive, because it's not paying enough. So people have two jobs. The number of second jobs and third jobs is increasing rapidly. But each one of those are considered a job, even though it's only one worker doing two part-time jobs, and the income doesn't change. You know, if all your full-timers got laid off and they had a part-time job and got a second part-time job, you'd double the amount of employment in the country. So there's a problem there. There's a problem there in the job numbers, I think. And that's why you see, you know, 200,000 jobs being created every month. But the problem is no wages going up. Well, people are losing a full-time job and they're getting two part-time jobs, right? And the part-time job numbers aren't fully recognized, I think, in the data, the temp jobs, the part-time jobs. Look, you know, someone gets laid off, they're a marketing specialist or something in the company, they lose the job. And then they say, okay, I'm gonna do some consulting. They'll, you know, hang out their consulting stick here. And they say, oh, when they get surveyed, oh, yeah, I'm working. Well, they may say it, looking for a job working, but and they may get intermittent jobs doing this consulting work. But, you know, they're really not working. They're not working in the sense of getting the same income and certainly don't have the same benefits. But they get reported as working, you see. So there's all kinds of problems with the job data, and that's why we keep seeing 200,000 jobs a month when the economy is flattening out, slowing down and flattening out. Big problems, I think, big problems with this data. And we're going to see, you know, 3 months of 200,000 jobs being created here in 2016. And the economy is stagnating, going to stagnate. You know, last fourth quarter, it was only, it started out just a few tenths of 1%. It almost flattened up. Then they adjusted that number, that GDP number, so it's like 0.7%, which is really pretty poor. And then we're going to see a second quarter of barely any growth. So how do you get 200,000 jobs for 6 months every month and the economy's flattening out? Well, you get it because they're part-time jobs, you see, and temp jobs and gig jobs, and none of those jobs pay much. That's why wages continue to stagnate and fall. They can't understand why all this job creation, why we're not getting any wage increase in consumption going. Well, that's the reason why, because the jobs are such low, poor quality jobs, and they're really overestimated, in my opinion, right? As is GDP. As I've said many times here before, you know, you take the U.S. GDP numbers and you take $500 billion out of those GDP numbers because it's just redefinitional stuff that occurred in 2013. And that's about 0.3% of the GDP number. So, you know, whatever the GDP number is, you know, just take 0.3% off of that. If it's 0.7% GDP growth in the fourth quarter, you know, take 0.3% of that out. That's just redefinition. So you really got 0.4 of 1% growth. And we'll see what it is here on April 28th in the first estimation, the first quarter growth. But, you know, some sources are bank research departments and so forth are predicting that it's going to be almost zero. Right? And that's an interesting development because it will mark the fourth winter that we've had a collapse of the U.S. economy. four winters almost in a row here. I think there's just 1 year between 2011 and this one where the winter quarter, fourth quarter, or the first quarter, relapsed, as I call it. And a relapse I've defined as a single quarter collapse of GDP. In other words, not two consecutive quarters, not negative, but, you know, collapse, stagnant, less than 1% growth. And then in the summer, the numbers seem to pick up, you know, robustly, which suggests to me there's problems with not just the job numbers, but the GDP numbers as well. Why every winter you get this collapse in GDP and then you get an over-average growth in the summer. That means there's some problem with their seasonality adjustments going on with GDP numbers, in my opinion, here. It can't just be coincidental that every winter we've got a collapse of the U.S. economy, and then the summer it generates even more on average. But, you know, you average this all out, and you're really well below 2% GDP growth. You know, you're on 1.7, 1.8 long-run GDP growth, which is about half of what's normal in the U.S. So the U.S. is growing about half of what's normal, and most of the proceeds of that growth are going to the 1%. Well, no wonder people are pissed off and, you know, voting for Trump and for Sanders. I mean, this is the explanation here. It's not rocket science. It's people finally waking up and saying, hey, something's wrong here in the U.S. economy and society. Why are only the 1% doing well and the rest of us are barely keeping our head above water or less? People are tired of it, you know, especially young people, you know, 34 or under. They're the ones who are getting whacked the most out of all this, and, you know, they're the ones who are supporting Sanders. And on the Republican side, it's more middle-aged workers, probably, I would guess here, who are discontent, and small business owners discontent. Okay, well, that's now we're drifting off into the politics of all this. Which is not unemployment, don't get me wrong. And I do want to talk before the show is over on an important proposal that Sanders has been raising here and several other issues, you know, like national health care and financial transaction tax and so forth. But we'll talk about that later. We'll come back to that. Let's continue looking at the global economy. We talked about Greece and the new austerity coming, you know. We talked about the splits occurring in the ruling economic elites, bankers, finance, capitalists, whatever, in Europe. And that seems to be on a long-run path of unraveling. What about China? What about China? Well, here's another area where, you know, this GDP statistics, I think, are really suspect. You know, China has been, despite a whole bunch of indicators showing its real economy slowing down, has been somehow reporting 6.8% growth. You know, they adjusted 0.1% here. Well, you know, the growth is slowing a lot faster in China than that. In fact, China's kind of like the U.S. The U.S. likes to report year-on-year numbers. So when the U.S. says, oh, the economy is growing at 0.7%, that's the fourth quarter, assuming for a full year compared to the previous fourth quarter, you know, in the previous year. So it's a year-on-year estimate for the quarter rolled up annually. It makes it look bigger than it is, you see. Well, China does the same thing. Right? That's why they're saying, you know, it's a 6.7% growth rate this year based on our latest fourth quarter data, right, or first quarter data of this year. But not that's on an annualized basis. If you look quarter to quarter in China, the first quarter, China's economy grew only 1.1% compared to the fourth quarter of 2015. That's the lowest growth rate since 2011 in China. And the fourth quarter was only a 1.5% growth rate over the third quarter of 2015. So if you look at quarter to quarter, not quarter annualized compared to a previous year, you get a number that's much less and robust than you would think. So China's really growing maybe a 1% per quarter, right? That does not come out to 6.7% when you look at it that way, any more than the U.S. when it's barely growing a couple tenths of a percent here for the last 6 months, means that there's a real economic recovery going on. In fact, it's been getting slower in the U.S., and that's where we are. Well, why is the stock market booming then? Well, first of all, the stock markets in the U.S. are, 75% of it is all institutional trading. And that means, the big institutions, the hedge funds and all these guys are mutual funds are moving the stock up, and then they move it down, and they make money when it goes up and it goes down. You know, it's back up over 18,000, the Dow, after having collapsed, earlier in the year. What was it, 16,000 or something, thereabouts? It's recovered all of that, and then some. It's not based on the real economy recovering that much. It's all based on speculators who take the slightest indication of any growth anywhere, and they boost it back up. They like to move it up and down, the stocks. Okay, getting back to China and its GDP numbers, there are now increasingly alternative estimates by reputable sources that pretty much verify that the Chinese economy is slowing rapidly, okay, much more than the official 6.7%. I suggested if you look at the last two quarters, barely 1%, that's a better indicator. But, even annual estimates here, let's take the case of Capital Economics Research. What do they what are they estimating here for 2015, for last year GDP growth rate in China? Well, China's 6.7, 6.8, right? Official. Well, Capital Economics says no more than 4%. That's what China grew last year, 4%. Down from double digits, in 2010-11, it was growing, 10 to 12%. Now it's down to 4% growth rate. I think that's more accurate, far more accurate, than the official 6.7%. Okay, so how about another source, Lombard Street Research? These are all independent research sources, economic research sources, of the business class itself here in the U.S. Well, what do they estimate for 2015? They estimate even lower, somewhere between 3.5% and 4% was what China grew last year, not the 6.7, 6.8. So it's interesting that we're looking at about a half of what the actual growth rate is by these independent estimates in China. Very interesting, and we'll see where China keeps to go. Now what China's been doing here is engaging once again, as the economy has been slowing down, in a mini stimulus. This is like the fourth or fifth mini stimulus since 2013 in China. Whenever there's a problem going on in China economically, with its national economy, they quickly respond with a fiscal stimulus and an even greater monetary stimulus. In other words, pumping even more money and liquidity to keep their stock markets from falling and to keep capital flight from occurring out of the country, and to stimulate business here in China. Liquidity, give more loans. You got a massive problem of debt accumulation in China. Not at the government level so much, although local government, yes. But in the private sector, massive, massive debt, both bond debt and loan debt going on. And yes, China has a lot of reserves and can pull them out, as we saw last year when they pumped nearly $1 trillion to keep money in the economy from flowing out and to repump up their stock market that was collapsing. They spent $1 trillion of their reserves to do that. And they still have several trillion more that they could use. Yes, they have those resources, but they're not unlimited resources. They can't do that forever. And what they're doing is pumping more liquidity, the China Central Bank and other banks, into that economy, which raises the debt and destabilizes that economy even more long run. So, the combination of many fiscal stimuluses and continued massive monetary injections periodically stop the descent of the real and the financial economy in China. But what it means is that even more liquidity, more debt is piled on debt in China. At some point there will be a reckoning for that problem in China, no doubt. Exactly when, who knows? But we've had since the January low, we've had a little bit of a recovery in the impression of what's going on in China. They stem some of the flow with this injection appear to have stabilized the downward descent in China. At the same time, it looks like this talk about negotiations and global crude oil prices, which are going on in the Mideast now, has stopped the collapse of global crude oil prices, which had plunged down into the high $20 per barrel there at the worst case earlier in this year. Just the talk of negotiations has brought the oil prices back up to around $40 a barrel. And that has served to boost the stock market a little bit because stocks in the U.S., because there's this close correlation and linkage between oil prices and stock prices now. So that seems to stabilize the global economy a little bit, as well as the China stimulus appearing to stabilize. And then the Fed, the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank, has decided not to raise rates. Interest rates, short-term rates, and long-term rates of U.S. interest rates have not rising as fast. So the U.S. dollar is not appreciating as fast, and actually is declining. That has two major effects globally. The fact that the interest rates aren't being raised by the Fed, and therefore the dollar is not rising as a result, because those two are correlated, it's had a positive effect on emerging markets. You see, when interest rates rise in the U.S. and the dollar appreciates, then the currencies collapse in these emerging markets. And collapsing currencies, Latin America and so forth, ends up in capital flight out of those countries. No one wants to hold their investments in a currency that's collapsing because it's a loss, so they sell those currencies and they move their money out to Europe and the U.S. and places like that, into Japanese yen. If the dollar is not rising, which it isn't now because there's not raising, the Fed's not raising rates, then you have a stabilization in the emerging economies as well. Less capital flight and therefore more investment. The currencies don't collapse, less in import inflation as if the currency's not collapsing and so forth. So we've got a stabilization going on temporarily in emerging markets, just as we have a stabilization going on in China with its mini surplus and in liquidity injections, and just as we have a stabilization in global oil price collapse because of these negotiations. So, what looks like the converging crises of the January, February this year, it looks like they've abated a little bit. And, of course, that's a green light to the speculators, stock speculators, to pump up the U.S. stock market. But these oil negotiations are not going to come to a permanent solution here. We're going to all... The estimates are that oil prices will fall again. China's mini-stimulus is not going to last very long. It never has in the last four cases. And the Fed is going to have to raise interest rates at some point, which is going to cause renewed problems in emerging markets in general. The Fed has to raise interest rates because keeping interest rates at eight years at nearly 0% is beginning to have significant negative effects on the U.S. economy. You've got tens of millions of people, retirees and others, who haven't been able to save a penny, even though zero rates have meant investors can borrow money from banks and reinvest it in stocks and so forth and make a killing. Speculation, right? But real people haven't been able to save anything. And it's not just the direct savings of households that are languishing, but it's pension funds and insurance annuities and so forth. These pension funds, insurance companies are having trouble with near zero rates or low rates earning returns here. And these funds, pension funds, so forth, are increasingly in trouble. Well, that's trillions of dollars more of lost income that's coming for retirees and people who are putting money in pensions and 401ks and IRAs and so forth. They're not making anything. It's really a direct transfer of interest earnings from them to capital gains for professional speculators. So we're redistributing the money from the first group to the second group in the U.S., and that's beginning to have problems. Of course, it's also generating political problems for the Federal Reserve, which people are saying, well, you know, all you're doing is helping speculators and financiers and banks and so forth. You know, what about us, our savings, our lifetime pensions and our savings income, which has disappeared for 8 years now. So the Fed is under great pressure to raise those rates, and it will. It will. But the problem is, when it does that, you've got a renewed problem in emerging markets. Right? As I said, more currency collapse there, more capital flight, and slowdown of those economies. Now, so long as the Fed does not do this, does not raise rates, it's putting renewed pressure on Japan and Europe. How's that happening? Well, if rates aren't raised, the dollar stays low, and Japan and Europe have to lower the value of their currencies even more through more QE, and now when QE isn't working very well, through negative interest rates, NERPs. Desperation. Japan and Europe, desperate. If the U.S. would raise the dollar, then Japan and Europe would not have to engage in more QE and NERP in order to drive their currencies down to stimulate their exports, you see, and grow their economy through exports. That's the problem. Japan and Europe are so dependent on exports, export-driven growth, that they're buffeted by U.S. Policies in China. Both. They're caught between the U.S. and China, rock in a hard place here, and they're desperate, Japan and Europe, and their answer to this has been to pump more and more, even more liquidity into the economy than the other capitalist sectors to drive down their currency, to lower their cost of production, to increase their share of global exports and thus economic growth. In an economy where global exports and global trade is shrinking, you see, that's why this export-driven trade policy of Japan and Europe is not working, and they're squeezing their currency in order to get an advantage, but now they're going to squeeze their workers even more. That's what labor market reform is. You know, if we can't get an export advantage by driving the value of our currency down, what we're going to do is squeeze wages even more, and that's what labor market reform in Europe is all about. you know, let's make Greece the template, the labor relations template all across Europe. That's what they want to do. Okay, so what this means, if the Fed is not raising rates and the dollar stays low, it benefits emerging markets but harms Japan and the EU. Well, why would the Fed want to do that? Well, the Fed has decided that U.S. multinational corporations and emerging markets are more important to be concerned about in terms of their policy than multinationals, U.S. multinationals doing business in Europe and Japan. You know, because like in Latin America, U.S. corporations play a big role there and have make a lot of money there. But if their currencies in those emerging market countries are collapsing, then the profits of multinationals are collapsing as a result of the currency collapse in those countries. So this whole thing about keeping interest rates low and not raising them by the Fed is really an attempt to protect U.S. multinationals in emerging markets, protect their profits, prevent them from collapsing too much. Okay, so that's the picture globally of where we are today. And, you know, in Europe, emerging markets, Japan, China, oil negotiations, that's the latest update. And, of course, the Greek situation and the Brexit that are coming. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll talk to you again next week.